author, lexicographer, and archaeologist. If you missed any portion of this show, you can find the entire show on my website at beyondyourfrontdoornorthwest.com. Well, Barbara, we are just about out of time, I'm sorry to say. Is there anything else you would like to add before we wrap up?
No, I would say you've been absolutely amazing in the questions you've asked and the areas we've covered. I think this is one of the better interviews, and I've been interviewed hundreds of thousands of times over the last 30 years. So,
well, thank you for that. You just made my day.
Kudos to you.
Thank you very much. And this really was such a fun and inspiring interview. I really enjoyed speaking with you. So thank you so much for taking time to be on the phone with me today.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in today. Missed a show recently? You can find access to all of my past shows at my website, beyondyourfrontdoornorthwest.com. Want to know what's coming up on Beyond Your Front Door? Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Beyond Your Front Door Northwest. Thanks to community radio stations who air Beyond Your Front Door, including Pacifica Radio member stations. And thanks to organ band Jumpin' the Rails for their rendition of Smith Chapel, the theme song used on this show. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. I hope you have a great week and get some time beyond your front door.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to Film with 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, as you know, which means we are funded by you, the listener. Today, in the first of two parts, Mona Bowen joins us to discuss movies whose titles we can't remember, before moving on to a costume drama series that she's recently discovered, and a little bit later, a pretty good shark attack movie. But first, we hear from Jeff Godsell, our LA correspondent, revisiting Fellini's Roma.
Back in 1963, Federico Fellini famously became indecisive about what his next movie should be about. His solution was to make a movie about a director who was indecisive about what his next movie should be about. The film was 8.5, thought by many to be his masterpiece. For the next decade and beyond, Fellini never seemed to have that problem. For 8.5, he simply relied heavily on dreams and memories, his fantasies, the subconscious for his sources, and developed his florid, circusy visual style, and this would all serve him well in the years to come, making a Fellini film look and sound like no other. And unlike his contemporaries like Visconti and Antonioni, his films would remain Italian in their language and in their cultural references. And so, in 1972, comes Roma, Fellini's homage to the great city, a loosely connected series of episodes, sort of, framed by a semi-autobiographical depiction of Fellini himself as a young man coming to Rome for the first time from his native Rimini. And while no doubt the source of some of the depictions of the past in Roma are in Fellini's memory, he takes his usual license for exaggeration and fanciful extravagance, so no one really knows quite where fact becomes fancy. The opening episode, for example, begins in almost documentary style as Fellini's film crew prepares to shoot their entrance into the city, driving in on the newly created highway surrounding Rome. With a camera mounted on a giant crane on the back of a flatbed truck, Fellini's crew navigates through traffic as rain begins to fall and the odyssey becomes more and more nightmarish. It's pure Fellini, with no dialogue or narration and no attempt to put any real meaning or context to the proceedings. It's a fitting introduction to the film, as if Fellini is saying, okay, here we go. This is going to be a wild ride. You're going to love it or you're going to hate it, but I'm pulling out all the stops. With its lack of connective narrative structure, Roma resembles Buñuel's Phantom of Liberty of a couple of years later. And as they are both pure examples of their director's vision, both kind of litmus tests for their appreciation. As the film travels back to the 30s, Fellini points his sarcastic wit at Mussolini and growing up in fascist Italy, an absurd time that sometimes can only be depicted with doses of surrealism. Fellini would expand on this and with more detail in the film that would follow, Amarcord. So when the young Fellini surrogate, looking rather absurdly handsome, arrives in Rome for the first time and meets the relatives with whom he will stay, he is hit with all the dizzying chaos of his new surroundings. The family, the cramped quarters, the food, the smells, the heat, the characters, the public square where everyone meets at night to eat and to argue, to sing and to fight. It's as if a month's worth of experience is crammed into one day and night. Here, and throughout the film, Fellini walks that tightrope between the extravagant and the grotesque, often borrowing from both at the same time. For my money, Roma is also his most hilarious, no more so than in the music hall scene where the real show is in the audience with humanity Italian style on display in all its glory. At first glance, Roma may appear to be a lesser work of Fellini, a caprice, often overlooked in favor of the more popular Amarcord to follow. But it's hard not to marvel at the creativity and expense and striking visuals that can only be found in a Fellini film. Pick your episode. Maybe it's the massive subway project deep underground beneath the streets of Rome where gigantic drills forge ahead, forced to detour when finding long-forgotten catacombs and buried architecture, with priceless frescoes that are damaged and dissolve when exposed to the new air. Or for many, it's the incredible fashion show for the cardinal and the priests and nuns in attendance, reaching a fever pitch and a frenzied score by Nino Rota when the Pope himself appears as if by divine intervention. Truly heady stuff. Roma is sometimes referred to as Fellini Roma, or even Fellini's Roma, and the best way to view it, as usual, is on the Criterion disc, which features a fantastic interview with Paolo Sorrentino, who himself made the great homage to Fellini and to Roma and to La Dolce Vita in his masterpiece, The Great Beauty. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And be sure to visit Jeff's website, Essentials of Cinema, for more recommendations. Now, here's Mona again.
So here we are once again with Mona Bowen, who yes. is our supreme guide to all things streaming and screaming.
I'm merely a dilettante.
I say screaming because the last time you said that all your comfort shows were strangely violent and apocalyptic.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, well, we don't need to delve into that too deeply.
No, let's not. Okay, we're going to discuss several things.
Sure.
Among them, a show that you discovered that you don't know how you missed. We're going to discuss briefly the new series from David E. Kelley, based on the novel Presumed Innocent, and also the movie, I should say, Under Paris. But first, we're going to explore the phenomenon of trying to remember the title of a movie that one saw as a kid and can't come up with now. And I've got a perfect example from my life that was at least a success when I finally remembered it, or stumbled upon it somehow. And I remember that Joe Bob Briggs, the drive-in movie critic, who is hilarious, by the way.
Very.
His column, he once used to invite people to send in just whatever they could think of for some fragment of their memory about a movie that they couldn't saw as a kid but couldn't remember, and he would sometimes be able to come up with it. It was not just him. He would invite the information, and either he would provide the answer or the other readers of his newspaper column would provide the answer, because he would have several people following in the paper or online. But we don't have a Joe. Well, we do have a Joe Bob Briggs. His show is back, where he shows a whole movie and then comments on it. It's Drive-In School, Drive-In Cinema School, something like that. We're here more to discuss you. So you have a movie that you saw as a kid and you can't remember a thing about it.
Well, what I can remember is so minimal. And of course, this is in the days of you had to sit close to the TV to change the channel, you watched what was on, and there was an afternoon.
What year? Can you guess at the year?
The year I saw it, or the year the movie was from?
The year that this even came up, you know, that. When you saw it on television.
Late 60s, early 70s.
Okay. So we know that it's not The Godfather.
No, because this was definitely a musical.
Oh.
Because I loved musicals. I always did. Black and white, very stylish, looked based on the sets as if based in, maybe filmed in the 30s or set in the 30s, early 40s, quite Art Deco. Very, extremely Art Deco. And it was an elegant gentleman and a very elegant woman with a beautiful dress dancing on a platform, if I recall correctly, round. There were dancing girls, as you have them, of course.
Uh-huh.
And I literally only remember this. It's just such a stupid detail. But these dancers are dancing. They're doing lively, peppy music, I think. I don't think it was an elegant waltz. It was something much more, you know, lively. And as the dance ends, they literally dance off the platform and drop out of the scene. And that is all I remember. It was not a dream. I am mystified. I have watched so many old movies. It's not 42nd Street. I don't know what. It's not Our Dancing Daughters or whatever. It's not any of the, I can't think of the names, but it's all the movies I thought it might be. It's none of them, unless I've somehow missed the scene. This has driven me crazy since I was a child. I can't believe it.
It's been your whole life. Yes. You can't remember this movie.
My whole life, I can't remember. And I have delved into things, but I just, and honestly, I couldn't even tell you if it was Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. I have no idea.
See, that was my first thought.
Would it be helpful? Yes, it would be helpful. Is this an impossible task? Yes, it is an impossible task. But if any of our dear listeners out there have any idea of what I'm talking about, please let us know.
Now, it's not an impossible task, because there is a book called The Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers Book that discusses every single dance scene in every single Fred Astaire. But another factor is that it's not impossible, because there's a finite number of musicals. You know it's in black and white, unless the TV you were watching was only.
No, it was color.
So it's not an impossible task, and I'll tell you, this is a fascinating topic, because we all have a title like this that we can't remember. I often run into people who can't remember a title of a movie, and because I've seen a lot of movies, but especially see a lot of odd genre type movies, which tend to be the ones that people don't remember, I can come up with the title. I remember talking to somebody and they couldn't remember the title of a specific Hammer horror type movie that starred both Christopher Lee what's his name? The guy that often appears in Hammer films with him. Matt Clark would know instantly who this is. But anyway, it was a Christopher Lee movie, but it was set on a train with a monster and they're going through Siberia. And I had just happened to have seen it a week earlier. So I said, oh, you mean Horror Express? And they were amazed. But it's just all happenstance. When I was a kid, my family and I went to a drive-in. I remember the drive-in even. It was called the Canyon Drive-In, way out almost to Jensen Beach And it was a movie theater that at night was a drive-in, but by day was a racetrack. And so it was the biggest setting for showing a drive-in movie. To walk to the concession stand, you had to basically hire a taxi cab to get there. It was so far away. And it was a triple bill of horror movies. And I can't remember all of them, but I've run into them since then, you know, because they become somewhat famous. They're really gory and ridiculous. Sure. But one of them was a black and white British science fiction style movie. And so I was seeing it not too long after it had actually come out, but some of the images in it were so striking that, you know, you go home and you think about it and you forget that you've seen it, and then life goes on, and then suddenly you're an adult and something reminds you of that movie and you go, what was the title of that movie? Because you've never seen it again, heard about, never read about it, never, it's never been on TV. And so for a long time, I couldn't remember the title of this movie and I couldn't find it in any reference books. But eventually, about, I don't know, 12 or 15 years ago, time all melds together when you're an adult. I unearthed it, so to speak, because it was an early 60s science fiction movie called Unearthly Strangers. And one of the premise is simply that the Earth is being invaded by aliens.
Through the dark street at night, a man runs for his very life. Runs as if all hell were at his heels.
In a little while, I expect to die. To be killed by something you and I know is here.
What unearthly and fiendish fantasy can drive a man to the very edge of insanity? What terrible sequence of events can destroy a respectable scientist at the very moment he completes his experiments?
The autopsy report called it hemorrhage of the brain. It seemed to me that an explosion had taken place right in the middle of his head.
But the aliens are disguising themselves as women, and they're marrying their way into the scientific communities. And there were two really striking moments. One, a man accidentally walks into a kitchen, or is about to walk into a kitchen, and he sees the wife of his professor friend reaching into the stove and taking out what do you put food in and put in the oven? A big square porcelain thing.
Okay,
anyway.
Yeah.
Don't you cook anything?
Corningware.
Okay. So she's reaching into the oven and taking out this Corningware bowl without an oven mitt. She's just reaching in and taking it out with her bare hands.
Okay.
That's a sign that she's an alien, you see.
Dean Marsh is in that movie.
I know.
Dean Marsh of all people. That's crazy. And John Neville. Because I'm looking at it now. I think I've seen this.
At the end of the movie, there's a dramatic confrontation at the end, and somebody has fallen out of a window and is on the sidewalk, dead. And the two scientists who have discovered this conspiracy rush down to look at the person. And as they're hovering over the body, they look up and they're surrounded by the faces of these women who are looking down, who've just walked by. And it's a scary moment because the professors are going, which one of them is also an alien?
Oh, wow.
She was lying on the bed with her eyes wide open.
Philip Stone is Professor Lancaster, who only believes what he sees. Yet could he believe what he saw? Gabriella Licudi as Julie, the wife who seems a stranger, almost an unearthly stranger.
Okay, so I saw it as an adult, and it is quite possibly one of the most boring science fiction films I've ever seen. Yet those two images really stuck with me for a lifetime. Unearthly strangers. I both recommend it and don't at the same time, because the Day the Earth Caught Fire is another British science fiction movie from that same era. Also extremely slow and black and white. All these British films.
Earth doesn't simply, really catch fire, I bet.
They all seem to be shot in winter under gray skies that are just hugging your left shoulder, you know, and they're just very slow and talky. No special effects. There are no special effects in this movie about the scientists and the female invaders. And there's no special effects in The Day the Earth Caught Fire. Then that one is just newsroom people and so forth. But the point I'm trying to make is that do not fret. You will someday uncover the title of this movie.
Yeah, and you know what? And the scene won't be anything like I remember it. That's the thing.
That's very true, because the scenes that I remembered when I saw them again in the movie look totally different from, you know, I've embellished them a little bit in my memory from seeing them when I was 8 or 10 to when I finally caught up with the movie when I was, you know, 98. Anyway, so that is a phenomenon of the times,
I'm sure there's a Reddit for it.
Yeah, and part of the problem is there are too many movies and too many TV shows.
Thanks, Mona. We'll take up the rest of this discussion next time. And you are listening to Film at 11 here on Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today.
Now we turn to our Los Angeles correspondent, Jeff Godsell, for another of his Essentials of Cinema, this time on a W.C. Fields comedy.
Back in the late 60s and 70s, there was a kind of a revival of some of the great film comedians of the 30s. The Marx Brothers, W.C. Fields, and Mae West were being discovered and appreciated by a new generation. Their films were popping up at festivals and college campuses. Their popularity was attributed by some to their irreverent, and in the case of the Marx Brothers, even anarchic humor. It seemed to fit the new counterculture with its anti-establishment point of view. And while there's some truth to this sociological explanation, a better one is simply that most of their films were still funny. You didn't see a revival of, say, the Ritz Brothers or Wheeler and Woolsey because, quite simply, their films were not. Revisiting these iconic clowns today, the best of their films are still funny, even if their names are brought up less and less with each new generation. Sadly, the one that seems most to be fading, with the general public at least, is W.C. Fields, although most contemporary comics know and love him.
How do you do, sir? Can you sit down?
Manicure?
No.
Haircut or shave?
Yeah.
I beg your pardon. Isn't your name Flug?
Yeah.
I thought so. I didn't recognize your face when you first came in.
No, it's all healed up since I was in here last.
Did you know you had your hat on backwards?
Oh, no. Oh, thank you very much. I had it on backwards day before yesterday, and a friend of mine came up and kicked me in the stomach.
Hey, what's that dog doing in here?
Oh, it's a very funny thing. The other day, a man was in here, and I was shaving him. The razor slipped, and I cut his ear off. The dog got it. Ever since, he's been hanging around here for... Go away, go away, go away.
Fields was 50 years old when the talkies arrived. And by then, he had already been in show business for over 30 years. First as a juggler, and then in vaudeville, and with the Ziegfeld Follies for 6 years. Fields even made a dozen silent films, surprising considering how verbal his comedy is. All the while, he was creating and perfecting his comic persona. While sometimes showing a mean streak, especially toward children and dogs, Fields was at his best as the henpecked husband, trying to get by, but constantly at odds with everything and everybody. In some ways, he was the Larry David of the 30s, always getting into scrapes, some of which weren't actually his fault. With his roly-poly stature and bulbous nose, Fields remained lovable, and if he liked to have a nip now and then, well, who could blame him? Fields' drinking was legendary, and he was able to work it into his characters quite well. Many of his sound films are just reworkings of routines that he had been perfecting for years. The screenplays, such as they were often constructed by Fields himself, using his colorful pseudonyms like Otis Kribblecoblis and Mahatma Kane Jeeves. While many of his films contain priceless moments, his best, It's a Gift, from 1934, is perfection from beginning to the end of its tight 68 minutes.
Open the door for Mr. Muckle.
What?
Open the door for Mr. Muckle, the blind man.
How about my kumquats?
What'd you say?
Kumquats!
Wait!
You got that door closed again, huh?
I'm awfully sorry. Come on, this
way. What's that?
All right. Think nothing of it. Just little glassware.
What?
Just little glassware.
What's the matter with you? Can't you talk?
Here's your pipe, here. What can I do for you?
Have you got any chewing gum?
Yes, we have.
How about my kumquats?
Coming.
Fields plays put-upon grocer Harold Bissonnette, or Bissonnet, as his wife prefers, and as Fields tries in vain to correct many others. It's Harold against the world, but fortune seems to come in the form of an inheritance. With this, Harold can make his dream come true. He buys a plot of land in California where he and his family can retire with an orange grove, just like the one in the photo that he's been carrying around. It isn't long before it's discovered that the land is worthless, but not before some hilarious vignettes involving a display of light bulbs in the store and a blind and deaf customer, as well as Fields' attempt to get some sleep on his balcony, only to be interrupted in the most improbable and unfortunate ways. The family heads out west in their old jalopy just the same, getting into a couple of scrapes along the way. Looking at the beautiful California landscape en route, Mrs. Bissonnette starts to warm a bit, thinking, well, maybe this wasn't such a bad decision after all. Well, all hopes are dashed, however, on arrival, when they see that their new land is a barren plot with a rundown shack and a tumbleweed. How can this end well? Well, in a W.C. Fields movie, it can and will. As a car pulls up and a developer gets out, desperate to buy Bissonnette's land to put up a grandstand next to his new planned racetrack, Fields pulls out his well-worn photo of his dream orange grove. That's what he wants, and that's what he gets. Fields appeared in 5 movies in 1934. Then, after appearing in David Copperfield as Micawber in 1935 in a stroke of casting genius, Fields' output waned. Heavy drinking and chronic illnesses were taking its toll. After his last film for Paramount, The Big Broadcast of 1938, Fields was physically unable to appear for long on a set. It was radio that kept Fields' career alive, appearing several times on the Bergen and McCarthy show, developing a long-running mock feud between him and the ventriloquist dummy Charlie McCarthy. Writers had a field day with McCarthy targeting Fields' bulbous red nose, while Fields would remind McCarthy that he was made of wood. His health somewhat returning, Fields enjoyed a major late-life revival when Universal signed him for the films that many remember him best for. After You Can't Cheat an Honest Man came The Bank Dick, My Little Chickadee with Mae West, and finally the surrealist Never Give a Sucker an Even Break, featuring the movie within a movie, with Fields pitching his thoroughly ridiculous screenplay to the studio. Wacky as they are, these later films relied a bit more on slapstick for my taste, and they just can't compare with the comic perfection of It's a Gift.
I want kumquats!
Coming! Oh, almost forgot the chewing gum.
Where's my gum? Sit down, Mr. Buckle! Sit down!
Here's your chewing gum. 5 cents, please.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lug that with me. Send it.
Oh, yes.
Harold!
This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks again, Jeff. And thank you for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next time, so until then, keep watching the screens.
We're trying to find a way of projecting ourselves into another world through the power of thought. To land, without having used the conventional means of travel, on the surface of another planet. What if they've already done it?
Starring John Neville as the scientist engaged on space research.
who suddenly finds his life a living nightmare.
I'm telling you, I thought she was dead. She was lying on the bed with her eyes wide open.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community